Hey gang, are you in a band in Austin and you're looking to make the leap from rickety schmoes to full-on pros? Well, you can start by rehearsing at Space. Space is a state-of-the-art, affordable venue for rehearsal and recording located just a few short miles south of downtown Austin. Countless pros, including myself, practice there. Simply call them at 512-448-9518 or go to spaceatx.com. Tell them you heard about it on How Did I Get Here and get one free hour of rehearsing. All right? Quit being a schmo. Get with the pros. Space, rehearsal and recording. Let's get down.
And you may ask yourself, well, how did I get here?
It's time for How Did I Get Here? And now here is your host.
I'm Johnny, I'm your host. Welcome to the show. I hope that this show finds you in perfect health and feeling good about life. Those are good things to be feeling good about. I right now am feeling incredibly good about life as I've been drinking iced coffee like a maniac. And right now, at some point, I'm going to crash and I'm not going to feel as good about life. So I figured I should probably get on the microphone, do this intro for this show while I'm feeling really good about life before I start feeling really bad about life. It's almost like that post-cocaine thing, you know, like, you know, you do a bunch of coffee and you feel great. You're like, man, I can do more stuff than I've ever done. I can think faster and more better than I ever have. If I was like in a James Bond situation, I had to get myself out of some trouble real fast. If I was on a lot of coffee, I'd probably be able to think on the same level as somebody like James Bond or Spider-Man. But then afterwards you start crashing. You're like, fuck, what did I do with my life? What is this fucking career? What is a podcast anyway? So that's what I'm doing. I didn't mean to take you through the inner workings of my mind, but I figured I would. So right now I'm on a high. I'm riding this crest. It's like surfing. The wave is at its full crest, and I'm just surfing down, man. I'm no chance of crashing yet. No thought of crashing. Well, right now, I am a little bit obsessed with the fear of crashing, but I don't want to crash into the water and not be able to swim. Hi, I'm Johnny. I'm your host. Welcome to the show. I have a great show for you guys today. Have the amazing Bruce Salmon is on my show. He just put out a record called The Barrel of Monkeys. You guys, I've known Bruce for over 20 years. Since he was in the band Joe Rockhead, and I was in the band Mr. Rocket Baby, they let our band open for them. And, you know, once when I lived in Houston, I watched Joe Rockhead do a sound check. I think I went to the show, too, but for some reason, I really remember being at their sound check. So I saw him at one point, like in 90-something at their sound check, watching him at Fitzgerald's in Houston when I lived there. Anyway, so Bruce, he has done a lot of different stuff, man. His son is Ellar Coltrane from that 12 Years movie, the big movie. He's like a legitimate movie star, and I think he's like 18 now. Anyway, Bruce is doing his thing. He has turned into kind of a troubadour songwriter guy. He's going around playing with all these different people. He told me about this culture of like community marching bands, which are like these independent marching bands made up of people who just want to play music. And that's what really what Bruce is, where Bruce's head is at. Like, he just wants to play. He just wants to make stuff. And that's beautiful. He's just running around the country, just kind of like doing his thing, which is what you do, I guess, when you're an artist. That's what you do. But he's out there doing it, and he's living the dream, and I'm very happy for him. I'm glad we got to sit down and catch up for the first time in many, many years. Haven't seen him in a while. Anyway, he played with Alejandro Escovedo. He was like the weird synth guy in that band, and now he's out there. He's playing this kind of like Eastern European-influenced kind of Tom Waitsy kind of jams that I really didn't expect from him, but it's fantastic. It's got some jazz feel to it. It's got some blues feel to it. It's got old-timiness to it. It's got a very organic vibe, a lot of organic instruments. So Bruce Salmon is out there, and he's doing stuff. And we will have a great conversation. You will enjoy it. I'm sure you will. I did. It was fantastic. It was long, and we had a lot to talk about. We had a lot to catch up on. So sit back and enjoy my conversation with Bruce Salmon coming up in just a minute. First, let me tell you what's going on with me if you're listening to this the day it comes out, Tuesday, October 14th, 2014. It's my birthday. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's my birthday. So that's going on. I don't have a big specific birthday plan because last year I did a birthday thing and ended up getting really drunk. And I got drunk real fast. I tried to leave without saying goodbye to people. And I set off the fire alarm at this place, the Volstead here in Austin. Jesus. Bunch of people came too. It was really nice, but I felt like a jerk because all these people came and I just got trashed. Anyway, so I'm just going to go to dinner tonight with my girlfriend Zuri and her sister and my cousin Emily. Just, hey, quiet times for America. I had a crazy week last week. I went to Arizona. I went to Scottsdale with Skyrocket on Wednesday morning, and we played a show there, a big show for a big company, and it got crazy, man. It was real weird because it was mostly men. It was like the chemical department of a giant company. I'm not going to say the name of it because it's just not. I don't want to mix or, you know, go out and talk shit about people that pay. But I'm not talking shit about them. But I would never want it to be construed. Okay, you got to keep your stuff right. Especially when you have a show like this where you like to talk about what happened. So we play this thing for the chemical arm of a giant company. And it was all dudes. Literally. There was like 200 people there and about maybe 20 girls. Amazing, right? Just like 20 chicks. Like fucking 180 dudes. Sausage Fest United. We had a great show, though. A lot of the people got up and sang with us. We don't normally do that, but man, these people could really sing. The people that got up and sang could really sing. At the end of the show, this is no exaggeration, probably 40 people came on stage. It was a giant stage. They had jumbotrons on the side, and they were filming the whole show or, like, you know, projecting the whole show on the jumbotrons and close-ups on people, and everyone was kind of being goofing, playing to the camera and being funny. It was a good time. And then we got up the next morning, flew to Houston, played a show there, fundraiser for a college, and did that. Or not fundraiser for college, fundraiser for like a scholarship to give kids to go to college. Any college, I think. I don't know. Some kind of thing there. And once again, a giant screen behind us, but it didn't really show us. I think it was just showing like weird shapes and stuff. Yeah, we played that thing, and man, we were exhausted. You know, we had to get up. We had to fly out from Scottsdale to Houston at 7 in the morning. So we had to be at the airport at like 5:30. My God, it was so early. And then we played that night. Everyone was pretty exhausted and then drove home after the show, drove back to Austin from Houston. Needless to say, Friday, I was worthless, man. I didn't really do anything. Saturday, Skyrocket played here in town at the 1-to-1 bar. I was sad because last time we played there, there was a lady that had bongos on her legs, like strapped to her thighs, and she would just jam the whole time, like in the audience. But she was not there this time, so I did miss her. Anyway, that's what's going on with me. Got a crazy a week this week of rehearsing. Got to learn a bunch of stuff for a wedding we're playing on Sunday, and I think there's going to be a little rock star action at that wedding. I'll fill you in on it next week. Tell you how it went. And also, Skyrocket's playing in Fredericksburg on Saturday, whatever that day is. I don't know. It's October 20-something. But we're playing there that day. Oh no, October 17th. Say 18th. October 18th. Saturday, October 18th, Fredericksburg at the Crossroads Saloon. So if you're in Fredericksburg, come on out and check it out if you like the Skyrocket. Okay? Man, crazy week last week. Getting into crazy week this week. It is my birthday, so happy birthday to me. It's my birthday. Quiet dinner, chilling out, getting older, no more parties. Well, maybe next year a party. Maybe every other year I'll have a party. Still want to have a roast. I wonder if I would invite a certain amount of people to my roast, and I would, could I pick the roasters, or would somebody pick the roasters? Can you imagine? What if, like, my ex-wife showed up or something? I'm like, oh no, shit, don't roast me. Maybe Bruce Salmon would come. He could come and roast me. He seems like he would be pretty nice about the roast. We have a great conversation, all right? Bruce is out there. He's got a new record out called Barrel of Monkeys that he made with a lot of people that I love, a lot of people that have been on the show, John Bush, Donnie Wynn, just to name a few. A lot of great musicians, and he's out there traveling, and he's on his way to Florida now to spend a little while chilling out with his mom and writing some new music. So, hey, without further ado, let's get to my conversation with Bruce Salmon. All right, let's get down.
Up at the crack of dawn to have coffee with a clown. hauling my ass cross town to have coffee with a clown. Everybody knows my smile is upside down. Squirt me with a rose, turn my luck around, turn my luck around. Haul my ass cross town, have coffee with a clown, coffee with a clown.
Oh, yeah?
We did a gig together in Sebastopol.
He was playing with you?
Yeah.
Awesome. Did you open for Carolyn or something?
No, it was just a restaurant gig on a Wednesday night. Just that the guy said, well, they prefer a duo. And I was like, oh.
Yeah.
Hanging out with Rob, so. Do, 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 do.
You got it? Here, say it again.
Should I be able to hear myself? Yeah.
Can you?
Yep.
Okay, good. Yeah, so you played with Rob. I mean, you're like just rolling.
Yeah.
Rolling with the times.
I pulled up Roots from Austin at the beginning of May. I finished making this record with a bunch of Austin and
right.
New Orleans people. And then just, like, I don't have it online yet. I'm going to take care of all that business now that I'm done traveling. Just kind of get my online presence more up to date.
So are you selling this on at your shows?
Yeah.
Okay.
And it's at Waterloo and End of an Ear and stuff. And
good.
Record stores that I visited between here and Alaska.
Yeah. Oh, you played in Alaska too?
Yeah, I was up in Alaska for a month.
Wow. Okay. So, man, when was the last time I even saw you?
I think we run into each other at shows that are crowded with a lot of other people every once in a while, but...
Hey, man. How are you?
Hi, Johnny. I'm fucking great. It's great to see you. Sorry, I don't know if I can throw... if I should censor my language or not.
Oh, no. You can cuss all you want.
Okay.
It's total freedom here.
Cool. Yeah, I did a radio show not too long ago where they had to go back and bleep some stuff.
Yeah, that's...
Because I get excited. My adjectives, you know? I'm not, like, insulting anybody.
No. You just say you're excited. There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
Where... you're going to New Orleans next? You said you're going to Florida next?
Well, I'm going... my mom lives about 4 hours from New Orleans in Florida, and I'm going to go kind of hole up there and write a new album and... cook for her and fix up her house a little bit and play shows along the Gulf Coast, you know, around there in the panhandle of Florida and between Florida and New Orleans. And that's pretty much what I'm going to do the next month and a half. And then I'm going to come back to Texas for about a month and a half between Austin and Big Bend. I spend a lot of time out in West Texas in Big Bend and Terlingua and Lajitas and Alpine and Marfa.
You play out there too?
Yeah, I play out there a lot.
Yeah.
That's kind of what got me started doing solo stuff. I was hanging out there and just started playing and people liked it. So I kind of just kept it going.
Well, it's amazing. It's cool that you're out in front now. And now I guess apparently all alone too.
Well, a lot of the time, I mean, I've had a trio in Austin the last week. And I kind of, you know, based on the show and...
Is it John and Brad?
No, it's a... Amanda Kitchen's playing accordion and singing, and this girl named Janie Cowan, that she's from Anchorage, but she lives in Austin, but I met her up in Anchorage, and I stayed with her and her mother up in Anchorage, and we played a bunch of shows up there, and now we're both down here, so, and she's great, great bass player, upright bass and sings, and so I got two girls that sing great and write
that's
their own
awesome.
Music, and, you know.
Yeah.
So that's the trio. That's who I'm, tomorrow's, I got two shows tomorrow before I leave town, and it's both with them.
Oh, wow. Where are your shows?
We're playing at the Hat Shop on Congress, the Gorin Brothers, so I can get a hat for my birthday. And then there's a art opening at Circa 13 for a friend of mine, Flip Solomon. And we just decided to combine her art opening and my birthday party so that I could have a birthday party that had free booze and she could get a few extra people to her art opening. So
that's good.
Kind of combining occasions.
So were you, there's like an Eastern European... Am I wrong?
Oh, no, I totally studied that big time.
When? Like, since I've seen, over the last few, when did this come about?
Well, you know, I was touring in Alejandro Escovedo's band playing synthesizer.
Right, I saw you doing that. Yeah, you're totally, electronic in that. Now you're playing, weird.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of got to where, to be totally honest, like, I'd been doing rock and roll since I was 10 years old in bands, and I kind of was in my early 40s and was going, man, I don't really want to be playing rock and roll when I'm 50 years old. And I quit his band, even though it was a great band and I loved playing with all of those guys. And I didn't know what I wanted to do, and I met an accordion player named Dylan Blackthorne that has that damn band. I just met him at a campfire and heard him play an accordion and went, like, it was almost like I finally found my folk music. All of the old stuff from my grandfather from Hungary and from all the people that are in my background, it felt like it was genetically awakened. Like, I could, all these scales I had always played that didn't fit in rock or funk, that's the scales, you know, with the harmonic minors thrust in various places in the scales. And so I just started learning that stuff and playing klezmer music, and then spent a couple of summers in Bulgaria and roaming around Romania and Hungary and Greece and just going to dance camps and seminars and getting the source of it, you know?
Yeah, you gotta, with those kind of like traditional styles of music, all of them, like those weird, like, you know, like tabla guys, they're not allowed to play unless they've like practiced in a room for 63 years.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I didn't quite do that, but...
No, but yeah.
But I mean, you know, my feelings about it is that music, we're attracted to it. I was attracted to it because of the rhythms are really intriguing and challenging, and the scales are also, you know, it's not the norm. And so it was like, just, oh, how do you do this? And there's a certain Western inclination to go, look what I can do. I'm a badass, you know? Right. And then, but realistically what it is that's folk music, and if you're showing off too much, then people can't dance to it, and it's pointless. If you can't do those circle dances to it because you're throwing in too much fancy soloing and tricky stuff, then it's not the real deal. You know, you need to be not on a stage. You need to be in the middle of the people dancing. And so it's kind of, that was the thing. Like any of those dance camps you go to play that music, dancing is at least as much of a part of it as playing the music. And it's, you know, it's just, I wouldn't even say it's humbling. It just puts you in the place of where you're serving the community as much as anybody else. You know, you're just part of it. And I never understood the rhythms until I started learning the dances. And then it became second nature because you're doing the dances.
Are there like Eastern influenced rhythms? Is that what the deal is?
Yeah. Well,
like,
I mean,
like Middle Eastern influenced?
Yeah. I mean, you know, there's a lot. My perception of it, which is as educated as it is, it's not deep. But, you know, it's enough that I've dove into it and been over there, is like a lot of the scales that are different than the Western scales came through, you know, from Asia to Europe through Constantinople, you know, Istanbul, and gradually merged with like the Western harmonies and kind of just all the different tribes claim them of their own. You know, you'll hear melodies that go from area to area, and they all claim it as their own song, and it's the same melody whether it's in Greece or Macedonia or wherever.
Right.
And it's just, you know, I mean, it's scales that are slightly different. I mean, some of them are based on instruments that have more than the notes that we're used to using, and then we kind of just round it off to the nearest note to be in the Western scales. And then a lot of the rhythms are, you know, they're counted in the Western way to where they're odd numbers. If it's written down, notated in Western music, then it's, you know, it'll say 7-8 or 11-8, or whatever, 25 or something. But the way that I learned it that really made the most sense to me is like it's just combinations of longs and shorts, and the longs are basically threes and the shorts are twos. But if you think of it in threes and twos, then it's a little more rigid. If you think of it in long, short, short, long, short, short, or, you know, that kind of thing, then it's more fluid. Yeah, it's more fluid, and you don't have to play every beat. If you play every beat, it sounds kind of, had a klezmer teacher in New York tell me, if you go like, then it's like, oh, that sounds Germanic, you know, and this was like a Jewish clarinet player in New York, so I don't think that's what he was going for.
Right.
So, I don't know. I mean, I dug into it for a while, and then, you know, we're in Texas, and nobody really cares or can really understand if you're singing in Bulgarian. And there's not that many people that know the dances. And so I had been writing a lot of blues songs during that time. And we worked on a record that was in that direction. And it was songs I had been writing that I hadn't been using in the bands that we were doing, the Eastern European music. And then people responded to it. And I was like, oh, these songs are coming out of me. This is what I should be singing, you know? It's like singing in English and playing more frequently in 4/4. People kind of relate to it more around here.
Well, what I've heard sounds and feels very authentic. You know what I mean? It doesn't feel like some weird fake thing, and it doesn't feel like totally traditional. It's just very, it's got a unique feel to it too. You know what I mean?
Well, I mean it, yeah. Well, thank you. I mean, that's, it seems like I wasn't entirely aware of that, but it just all got integrated into the vibe and the rhythm and the blood in my blood, you know, just,
yeah.
And it just started coming out that way. But see, it was just from playing all the time and studying this stuff kind of deeply and really playing with people that wanted to play it all the time and practice all the time and really study it. Some of the bands, it felt like they were just study groups, you know. It kind of felt like we were playing and making a little money, but it kind of felt more like
right. It
was just a group of people that, you know, oh, I want to play this on drums, and this person can sight read and by ear play this stuff on violin and clarinet, and so let's see how fast we can go through this repertoire and just absorb it, you know?
Yeah. Are you a good reader?
Pretty good. Yeah. I mean, I went to school for a while. I mean, my sight reading of lines is, you know, I have to do a little homework.
Yeah.
I can fake my way through it, looking at it. And if I work on it if I run through it for 20 minutes, then I got it. But
right.
But just as far as like basic kind of Sharpie chord charts, right. You know, I can fly, I do that and write that out. And that's most of the people I play with. It's kind of at that level. And, you know, there'll be certain lines that I'll have written out. But in general, it's just kind of, you know, once you hear the style of the music, they're all going in the same direction.
Right. So do you even have like an electric rig anymore? Like crazy, or do you have it? Like,
I do. Yeah. Somewhere? Yeah, I kind of got rid of it all and started rebuilding it, and it's really where it's at right now is not where I want it to be, but I'm heading that way. The next batch of stuff I'm doing, like I've been working in pedals a lot, like just using tremolo and a good slap back, and kind of there's a tone I hear in my head that I'm getting towards.
That's good.
And I think I'm going back to having a Telecaster again. It seems like a slim line will fit the sound in my head, you know?
Yeah, totally. Hey, let me ask you this. You were born in New Orleans.
Yes.
And were your parents like musical or something?
My mom was totally like, she's still a church organist. She's been a church organist for like 72 years. She's been playing in the organ in the church and she was 10.
Wow.
And her dad was a luthier from Hungary. He was like third generation, first son, got handed the, you know, got mentored in the skills.
And how did they get to New Orleans? Like, did they move straight there?
He came over in the 20s, you know. It's been uncovered in the recent history that he was escaping the persecution, like a lot of people of Jewish background in the 20s, and came over through Ellis Island and went to Chicago, and then started his own business in St. Louis and was playing, in an orchestra on a riverboat and going up and down the Mississippi, and met my grandmother in New Orleans and then started his shop down in New Orleans and, you know, proceeded to get in trouble with alcohol in New Orleans like a lot of people do.
when did you start playing? Like, was it just there? Was there like one of these organs in your house?
Yeah. My mom has always played. My brother was already having garage bands by the time I was even aware of what was going on. And there was it was both things. Like, you know, they were playing when I was 2 years old, they were playing Proud Mary and Gloria in the garage, and we had the Beatles records, and my mom was, you know, we were in the church choir and everything, so it was just kind of everywhere.
So you grew up like playing. It was like, when did you start playing guitar? Did you ask for one or did they give you one?
I started playing bass when I was about 15. I begged for it, and I started playing guitar not so long before I met you, like when I was about 25.
Wow. What, real quick, why did you want a bass? Like, because that's always a weird instrument when you're a kid, you know what I mean? It seems utilitarian, doesn't seem cool.
Well, it was because a friend of mine's brother just had a bass, and he played guitar, and he showed me some bass lines, and I could do them really easily.
Yeah.
And there was already people, some of whom you know. I mean, guys from that have wound up here that wound, you know, Don Lamb that works at Waterloo, and some of the guys that wound up playing in Year Zero, and Bill Hicks was one of the guitar players, and a lot of different players. That there were already a lot of guitar players, and it's like if you there was really not a good bass player in my high school, and it's like I got a bass and was playing in all the bands. Like,
were you
next
here by
week,
then? You know, or no, you were
in
there.
Houston.
Okay, Houston.
Houston, yeah, all like right. in Spring Branch.
Okay. So you started, you got your bass when you were 15.
Yeah.
And then did you have any bass idols then?
John Entwistle, Jack Bruce, and then when I was learning Pete Thomas, like the second Elvis Costello record,
oh, yeah.
I learned every song on that record, you know.
Yeah.
I learned every song on Who's Next and The Best of Cream and This Year's Model, and that kind of just covered a lot of rock and roll basses, you know.
Yeah. Were you in the zone where you could hear the bass lines?
Yeah.
And you were like, okay, there's a different thing going on.
Oh, yeah, yeah, totally.
Like this guy's doing his, there's, you know,
yeah.
especially those two guys, Entwistle
yeah.
And
yeah,
Jack Bruce.
Bruce. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Almost like its own song. Like you could take
yeah.
it and isolate the track and it's like you could. You
yeah,
know.
I mean, ultimately, I think that's why I became not that great of a bass player because, you know, there was just that period of time where the rhythm sections were really going off the hook on the three-piece bands. And then, you know, by the time I really started getting into it, it was kind of like playing that way was not in service of the song, really.
Right,
so
right.
I was hearing too many things, and so I just switched to guitar because I was playing too many notes on the bass, basically.
Right. So when did you move here from Houston?
Like 1980
oh,
to
okay.
Austin, yeah.
To go to school?
Yeah.
Okay. How long did you last?
What
How long
semester?
Did you last? One semester.
I went back to Houston for like 6 months and then came back up here for 30 years.
Were you playing in Houston and playing? What was
yeah.
that? What was
oh,
going
yeah.
on there in 1980?
Well, you know, punk rock was hitting Texas everywhere. When Raul's was happening in Austin,
yeah.
Rock Island was happening on Main Street in Houston.
Okay.
And I wasn't part of it yet. I was like kind of a little bit behind until 79 or 80 when I really started getting turned on to the Ramones and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But like we were playing at Rock Island, which became the punk club for a while. It was down at the south end of Main Street in Houston. And I was playing in a band that was called Spiny Norman. And we were very influenced by like Jethro Tull and Alice Cooper and like definitely kind of prog rock with a little bit of the Cars and The Who and stuff like that thrown
How
in.
How was that going to the punk club?
Well, it wasn't quite a punk club.
Okay.
It was becoming a punk club.
Okay.
Like we were
All
getting
right.
shoved
okay.
out
okay.
the door,
okay.
basically.
Okay.
We were
that makes
right
sense.
At the tail end of that being...
Right.
Like it was kind of cool for about 3 months. And then all of a sudden the bands from the coasts were coming in and people were excited about it. And I got excited about it. You know, I wasn't really interested in continuing to...
Prog out.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I fell in love with everything getting raw too.
Yeah. Who did you get to see anyone there like that was coming in from the coasts?
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Did you get to see the Ramones and stuff?
I saw the
time?
Ramones on the first time they were in Houston and Clash. I saw that tour in Houston with where Joe Ely opened up for Give Him Enough Rope, I guess, and the first Devo tour.
Oh, that must have been
and,
awesome. Where were those shows?
Devo was at the Texas Opry House. There was a lot of shows there. I saw Dave Edmonds there and the Ramones played
that,
at Cullen Auditorium and at it was called, it was an old Arthur Murray studio that they turned into a place called the Agora Ballroom on Richmond.
I remember that place.
Yeah, and that was happening for a
yeah.
while. Like, not only were the punk bands coming through, but like when I was living there, that the T-Birds played there twice a month, and that's when I got fully... That's why I had to leave Houston and come back to Austin. Like, I used to go see when the T-Birds were on their first couple of albums.
Yeah.
It just, like, that was the real sweaty was deal,
it
you know?
Keith Ferguson?
Yeah,
bass?
It was the original lineup yeah. with, you know, Mike Buck and then Fran.
Yeah.
Played drums and, you know, yeah, that way yeah, they were greasy.
Yeah.
I mean, I like, you know, I was more into that because of punk rock than I was into Stevie Ray because of the guitar solos. You know, I was just kind of not
it's
into guitar solos.
It's a little more
solos.
Naked.
Yeah, yeah. It was about the
simple,
song and the groove.
Yeah.
But then, you know, you moved up here, and I didn't really totally appreciate Stevie until I was, like, on a lengthy camping trip in Canada, and then I got in a car with a Texan, and they played some of his music, and I was just like, you know, I felt homesick, and I was like, oh, this is our culture, you know, this is, like, the real thing.
Dude. I was in L.A. in, like, 1999, driving a rent-a-car, listening to, like, the College Station. And this fucking song came on. I kind of knew who it was, and it just went on. It was a live thing. It was him playing forever. Like in the middle of it, I was like, oh,
that's what it is. Yeah. The most times I ever got into him was in other places.
Yeah.
The best show I ever saw him do that impacted me the most was at the Illinois State Fair, like after he became sober. So whenever that was, like 89 or 88 or something, and Greg Allman opened up and he played, and a storm was coming in, and they tried to close the show down, and he wouldn't stop playing. And they lowered the awning down to 7 feet right over his head, and water was blasting across the stage, and he just kept playing "The Sky Is Crying" and wouldn't stop. And it was just like, or actually, it was Texas Flood, was like. And I mean, and like my girlfriend was like, "Hey, it's raining, I'm leaving." And I was like, "I can't leave until I see what happens." We were standing in the horse track, just in the mud. And it was just, that's the moment I remember the most, you know. I think that might have been the last time I saw him.
I never saw him live. I saw him at Ray Hennig's when I was a teenager. Mark Hallman had to tell me that he was the guy that played on Let's Dance for me to be honest. He was like, "That's Stevie Ray." I was like, "I don't know who you're talking about."
The first time I ever went into Steamboat when I was a freshman at UT, before I had any idea who he was, a friend of mine who was a year ahead of me, one Friday night we were hanging out on West Campus, and she's like, "Oh, we're going to see this guy. You got to see this guy play guitar." And so we went, the first time I ever went on Sixth Street in 1980.
Wow.
When I was probably 18, and that's what we did. We went in Steamboat, and he was playing, you know. And then a couple weeks later, he was playing at it was the Arc at the time. It became the Pearl Street Co-op. He played at their Halloween party, and it was right when it was starting to get that he was a little bit bigger than fitting into something like that. So there was people just crawling over the walls and trying to get in and everything, you know. He had been already booked for the party, and things were already starting to happen.
Yeah. Were you playing out at that time when you first moved up here? You moved back after?
Yeah, I moved
college,
back. Well, right when months. I moved back, I started playing.
Okay.
And yeah, we played the first place I played was, I think it was called Ed's something, and it was like where Joe's Generic Bar was, and it was just it was across the street from the Ritz, and we were playing at the Ritz too, but when it was kind of gutted out and was a punk rock club.
Right. How did you see any good shows there?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Fishbone. Was the first Fishbone tour and it was like, and all the local guys were just starting to get into the funk, like a Doodat and Bad Mother Goose opened up for it.
Oh, yeah.
And that was pretty, and I saw the Dead Kennedys there and I saw them a few times over the years, but Scratch Acid opened that show, and it was the first time I'd seen them, and that completely blew me away. That was probably like 86, maybe something like that.
So all that time you were here, you were playing?
Yeah.
And just kind of like in punk bands or funk bands? Was a musical thing?
I really didn't do that much punk. I played drums in a punk band that didn't last all that long. But it was definitely more influenced by kind of new wave,
That was a lot
XTC.
Of stuff that I remember, when I moved here in 84.
Yeah.
Lived here for it was the fucking new wave city.
Yeah,
man.
that's what was going on. And we, you the know, beach. I wasn't ever.
Remember that place?
Oh, we played at the beach every once a month. Yeah, I lived right around the corner from there. And, and Club Foot before it closed. Right. And some other places. But those are regular places. I was kind of doing stuff that was just bad. You know, we didn't have enough under our belt to be that good at it, so it was kind of just bad new wave. And then, when I got really turned on to a lot of the rooted 60s music I had never heard, and really into the Sun era, Carl Perkins and Elvis, and Freddie King and stuff like that. I played with a guitar player that was really into a lot of that just really swinging R&B that was the really rooted stuff. And so we were doing that, and that was the band I first started really making a living at. And we were playing army bases down in San Antonio and stuff. It was called Patience.
Okay.
And we had a regular thing at the Hole in the Wall and the beach. And, the guy I was playing with, a drummer that I had grown up with, it was since fifth grade I've been playing with him. And he had been down at Trinity University, so he was really tapped into the army bases down there. So we were learning stuff there, and we didn't do cheesy cover stuff, but it was at that point, just like in the early 2000s when all of a sudden 80s music was cool. It was like all of a sudden in the mid 80s, all that early 60s garage garage and R&B stuff was cool.
Like when the Bengals came out and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, we're really influenced by The Who and The Kinks and Freddie King and Elvis and Carl Perkins and the surf music. Really good guitar player I was playing with, who is a lawyer in Houston now, but his name was Sellers Thomas. He was good. And But, you know, at that time, then a lot of kind of post-punk psychedelic funk started happening, and we were kind of rooted in this old stuff, so I got bored with it and started really... Like, I met Whammo, and I started writing songs with him, and started really getting into... I really like Doodad a lot, and, like, all the kind of heavy funk bands from the East Coast and the West Coast started coming through, Trouble Funk and Afrika Bambaataa, and when the Chili Peppers and everything started happening, it was just kind of... And the Neville Brothers were doing regular shows at Liberty Lunch back then, and all of that just kind of, like, made me get really into, you know, that heavy kind of sexy groove music. That's kind of... That's what I was doing when you and I met.
Yeah, yeah.
We were influenced by that.
I mean, that was a heavy, that was a really heavy time. I was just talking to John Bush, and there was like this sort of like neo-hippie thing that started sliding in towards the...
Oh, yeah.
That, I mean, you know, we all kind of like were part of that like vibe.
Yeah.
That was happening. It was with everyone kind of.
Yeah.
I think even grunge people were having it, but I just anyway. So how did Joe Rockhead come together? How did you get in?
We had a band going that was me and Steve Bernal and John Nelson and Whammo that was called Clang, and you know it was pretty volatile. That's just like most of the bands I was in back then. All these boys in their late 20s that thought they were hot shit. There was a bunch of egos, and so heads butted and fists flew, and that band broke up. And Steve and John and I kept playing together, and we were going to move to San Francisco, and I met Bob at a party, Bob Schneider, and we just kind of hit it off. We were just jamming at a party. I had a washed up bass. I was really kind of into making people jam at parties and turn off the stereos and being playing acoustic stuff back then. And so we met, and he wanted to play with us. So we played a couple times with that lineup, but then John got scooped up by Poi Dogs, and Steve was in the Killer Bees, and so they got busy. And I started playing. There was just a bunch of people playing together, and I was playing with some other people Bob had been playing with, and my brother started drumming with us, and then Bob started playing with us, and that turned into Joe Rockhead. It was Curtis Mackler, who's still one of my best friends and collaborators, and RT Sinister was playing keyboards.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then
that's the guy. That's the guy I never really knew in the
band.
Because when you guys, like when we did shows with you guys, wasn't he gone by then?
He didn't play like the last year. Like it, we had a falling out. And I mean, I don't have a falling out with him at all now, but you know.
Doesn't he have like a twin brother or something?
Yeah, he's got a twin brother who was living in El Paso at that time, but they both live here now.
Okay.
Rick.
Yeah. I remember the Thayer brothers. I remember one time going up and saying, hey, and I remember telling Bob, like, I don't know what that guy's problem is, but I was like, and he was like, oh, you know what? He has a twin brother. You might have been talking to some dude that you didn't
It's a
know.
Trip. Sometimes I'd forget. I mean, they had different colored hair, and it was pretty striking, but if I was just sitting in a car and not looking at him, I'd forget who I was talking to, because they had the exact same accent, and they had some very definite different tastes in certain things in life, but they're, you know, they're both really great guys.
And yeah.
Rob, RT has been doing solo electronic music under the moniker of Synthetamine for a while.
Oh, really?
I think he's made a number of records, and he plays pretty regularly. He just, you know, like a lot of us as we get older, you just kind of get sick of trying to keep a band together and figure out how to do it by yourself.
Dude, it's so hard. do you get anxiety about it? Because I do.
About?
Yeah, the first
about keeping
thing
about, a band together or playing by yourself?
Just anything that has to do with more than you.
It's really weird. You know, it's just been 2 years that I've been playing solo. And at first I was very anxious about it, of course, just nervous and you're naked. And then once I got used to it, the only time I get nervous now is playing with other people, even if it's people that are just completely solid. And I have no reason to think that they show up on time with their shit together, you know, but it's still, I feel nervous about it. I'm not as comfortable telling stories on the microphone because I feel like I'm representing other people instead of just myself.
And, right.
You know, so it's a little weird, but I love, there's nothing like playing with a band, I mean, we had a gig the other day that was just a 4-song set on John Bush's variety show, and it wound up being me and John and Brett Hauser playing
on
bass.
Sunday?
Yeah, Sunday.
Shit.
And Amanda Kitchens was playing accordion, and it was just ferocious. You know, it was like, oh, this is where my, it's part of, it's kind of where my music's going. You know, it is something that
you can push that lever and get back up if you want.
It's a little bit, there's a syncopation to what's coming out of me now that really, like, John is just in the breeze of it, you know. I loved playing with John very, very much.
Yeah, I just played with those guys. He was telling me about this, and his episode actually comes out day after tomorrow.
Oh,
but,
yeah?
Yes, I took this weird, like, nap at 3:30 that lasted 6 hours. I don't think that's a nap. But I went back to sleep at, like, 11.
Oh, that day? Yeah.
On Sunday. Anyway,
yeah,
so...
that's what happens.
Well, let's go back to this. So you guys got together and started doing the Joe Rockhead thing.
Yeah.
And you built a big fan base.
Well, you know, it was like...
I mean, it was huge.
Bob obviously could make up words on songs.
Yeah.
And when we were first playing the first few shows and parties, he was still smoking a little weed, and he wasn't all the way out in his full entertainment mode. And then we played a Christmas party the first season we were together, and it was videoed. I remember this vividly. You know, we watched it, and he was wearing a hoodie, and he had his hands in his pockets, and he just, like, he was pacing the room and going, I'm never smoking weed when I play again. And I'm quite sure, I wouldn't be surprised if he never has, you know, and that was probably 1989.
Wow.
But he just was like, and then shortly after that, we played a show where we were opening for somebody at the Ritz, and nobody knew who we were. And I saw him work a room in a way like I'd never seen anybody do it. Like, he just walked through and made all the girls start dancing with us. And I just was like, we were just keeping the groove going. And then, you know, that was like an epiphany of like, oh, this guy's got something else. You know, he's not like the regular guys we've been jamming with, you know.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, you could just see it.
You can take it to another level. See it.
Yeah. And I mean, and he learned it, you know. You know, we were a little bit older than him. We were already at the end of our 20s, and he was in his early 20s. And so there were certain elements of how to run a band that he was kind of glomming off of us. But, you know, we played all the time. And that, you know, which is kind of the way I always do it anyway. I just don't ever stop playing. I don't really care if I'm making money or not. We just play all the time. And so it happened fast. Like, he got really good at working a crowd really fast. And he, you know, he had a lot of stuff in his background that prepped him for it. That's his own story, but
he's been on here.
Yeah, but you know, so that's what I mean. The band was really good, and Steve, you know, when Steve replaced Curtis and then Pat Brown started playing with us, and they had played together, and so there was a number of elements that had been coming together in other ways up to that point, and it just all fell into place to where we could just play. And we were, you know, we were all living in the same house and rehearsing downstairs.
There's something
about
that.
And we were just like, we were playing 3 residencies a week and practicing 3 or 4 days a week and swimming in Barton Springs the rest of the time. And it was, you know, it was a good couple of summers.
Yeah, I bet.
And I was glad that I was old enough at that time to go like, man, we may tour the world or we may fall apart tomorrow, but like, this is like some good shit right now. Like when we were, after playing in Austin for about 8 years or 10 years at that point, it was like we finally had our summer as the toast of the town, you know.
Yeah
So that was a good thing. I was glad to appreciate it and not be like so caught up in what we were trying to accomplish that I couldn't savor it, you know.
Yeah Because that's interesting, because a lot of times as an artist you're so busy working on the next thing and where you're gonna go next that you don't
just step back and take a deep breath and just
But you do know, as you get older.
Smell the roses. Yeah.
Okay, this is a good time. So how long were you guys together? What, 5 years?
4.
4 years?
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, whatever. We just like so many relationships, people get sick of each other, and so you just wore out.
Yeah. I mean, this, you know, it runs its cycle.
Yeah.
Sometimes I feel like this, like when I look back on Mr. Rocket Baby or something, you know, band like that, and you're like, oh, okay, I see where it started to kind of like get mold. You know what I mean? And sometimes the faster the rise, the faster the
thing. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You're just, you know, you're treading water and you're expecting something else to happen and everybody. I mean, you know, to be totally honest, my opinions that I, you know, my perception of Bob at that time, there was a lot of struggle with egos and stuff. And like at that time, I didn't, it's with hindsight of seeing what he's, you know, his perseverance and prolificness as an artist and the way he's continually been way above average entertainer. At the time, you know,
it can be annoying.
Yeah, we didn't know it. We didn't know it. We didn't realize that he really is that special. I mean, he's a unique cat. Yeah, and we didn't really totally realize it. So, you know, everybody thinks their shit smells good, and all of a sudden it's a shit battle, and you know, but you know, it's nice to get older and just kind of look at that stuff and appreciate what it was and credit everybody and, you know, really realize what you learned from each other and everything.
Yeah. Do you look back and are you proud of what you guys were able to do musically and everything?
Oh, it was like, a blast, you know? Yeah. I mean,
it's a fucking really strong band.
It was a great band. Yeah. Not too long ago, I don't know where I was. I was way out of town and my son discovered some of that music and he had never heard it. And just like called me up and was just, I mean, he was some specific songs that like no one ever noticed that were like on the last album we made right when we broke up. And he just was like,
the one with the little kids on the cover.
Yeah. The No Going Back. And he just was kind of, there was a song that I always thought was great. And I never got any feedback about it. And suddenly, you know, 25 years later, it hits him.
Yeah.
And he was just like, man, that's a beautiful song. I just listen to it over and over. It makes me cry, you know? And it's kind of like, wow, we wrote some beautiful songs here towards the end. And we weren't in a market, you know, we were writing stuff that had more to it. And everybody was pulling different directions. So we weren't, you know, none of us, I mean, Bob kept doing kind of funk music with the Scabs, but I was tired of doing music like that, you know? Like, I wasn't 26 years old anymore. I was like 32 and about to have a kid, and it was kind of like, you know, it just was kind of, I don't want to say outgrew it, but whatever, it had served its use in my life as a single man roaming around trying to meet girls, you know.
Exactly. And when you play that kind of music, there, as a person that's making that kind of music, for the most part, that's the thing, is, you know, there's going to be girls dancing.
Yeah, that's what we
shows.
Were doing.
You live in
back
Texas,
then, for
sweaty,
sure.
They're going to be in shorts and tank tops, and your world will be really amazing.
Yeah, I was single that whole run. Yeah. You know, we were traveling all over the place, and it was a run for sure. We got to live rock and roll for a little while.
Sure. So then what did you do afterwards? What was your...
I kind of, you know, profile of that led to a couple of offers and opportunities.
Right.
That didn't really pan out, and I was just burned out on the business. You know, we had had promises and things had fallen through, and my heart was a little bit hurt and not in it. And I realized that just a few months. It didn't even take 4 months. And then, you know, I fell back in love with Genevieve, Eller's mom, and Eller was conceived, and it was like, I felt like universal message of like, oh, this is what I'm supposed to do now. You know, she and I were together when we were younger, and we were split up during that whole time of Rockhead being together. And then we got back together, and it was from the very beginning, it was kind of like, we're supposed to make a kid. That even before, and you, which had previously scared the hell out of me, but it just felt like that was what was supposed to happen. And it is what happened.
I'm just, all of a sudden hit me, this conversation that we had on like a corner sitting on a bench in Corpus Christi.
Right when she and I met again, when we got back together.
And that was our conversation.
Yeah.
I remember you telling me, and it seemed very romantic to me at the time.
It was. It really was. I mean, you know,
and maybe she wasn't living in Austin. You guys.
No, she was living in Austin. She had been married. You know, we had split up when we were young, and she got married, and I went off. Like, I really became a musician at that point. Like, all my high school friends moved away, and I started really digging in and living in houses with musicians and studying it hardcore. And then, you know, that kind of, when Rockhead ran its course and she got divorced in the same season, and we just landed in each other's world and created a human.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And so then, that adds a whole new level of life responsibility that you didn't have a year before with roaming around in that RV with the Joe
with those knuckleheads.
What? How was that on you?
If you know, I was like 32 years old. It felt
nice.
It felt nice. You know, I was in love, and I was, you know, I come from a strong family, and it felt like I needed to do my duty. You know, and I did. You know, I'm not perfect. I wasn't perfect at all at it. But, you know, I took it seriously.
Yeah.
And, I mean, you know, Frosty was a big mentor to all of us at that point. He was playing with a lot of us that were 15, 20 years younger than him. And he coincidentally, like at that point, he had about a 14 or 15 year, his son was that age, 14 or 15, and he was 14 or 15 years older than me. So I really I just started going to his house and picking his brain because, you know, I knew he had a good relationship with his son, and I was just kind of, you know, I didn't see a lot of mentors that were both good fathers and continued to be artistic in their musical lifestyles. You know, a lot of people either bailed on one or the other.
Right.
And so I remember him saying, give yourself 2 years that it's totally the priority so he knows your face. He goes, like, wash dishes if you have to, and don't care about singing some stupid song that is not as important as the child you made, you know? And he totally, I mean, I vividly remember that conversation, sitting, talking to him at a picnic table in over there in Guadalupe where him and Wayne and Daryl were all living. And it hit me. So that's what I did, you know? I, like, went back to work in kitchens and, you know, just kind of dug in, bought a house down in San Marcos and started driving school buses. And
I remember that.
Yeah. And, you know, and then after a couple of years, I started losing my mind because I wasn't playing music.
Right, right. But you did the thing that Frosty pointed out would be the, I mean, this is a tough, that's a tough call to make to stay artistic or to be a present parent.
But I think two year blocks of time, I feel that is like a really healthy, I mean, I think it's a natural way that life runs in cycles anyway. And if you look at it that way, then you don't feel trapped because you're like, just this commitment, and then you reassess, you know? Right. I mean, and that's kind of, I didn't realize that at the time, but I totally feel that way now. And it's not from that I learned it. It's from, you know, my whole overall life experience. But I really feel that like, just, okay, put in 2 years and then think about it. And then I really was like, you know, we were living in San Marcos and I wasn't playing music and I felt like I was, you know, I was driving school buses. I felt like I was a failure and like I had damaged my mind with drugs and, you know, that I kind of was like, okay, what do I do now? You know, how do I get it back? And I started doing crossword puzzles, you know. It was like, I really literally like, you know, we did a lot of psychedelic drugs and partying in those days. And I really, you know, I was started trying to learn electronic music, and when computers really started, you know, in the late 90s, when it really was like, you need to know this. Yeah. And I just kind of like, I couldn't read a manual. Like, I could not focus on teaching myself anything. And I was, you know, I felt like I had done too much damage.
Yeah.
And I really started by just like doing crossword puzzles every morning. You know, I read an interview with a singer that she said, well, that's my mental gymnastics. And I was just, all right, that's where I'll start.
Yeah.
And then I took like one, you know, fundamental computer basics class. And then I started taking different classes and it just got me like, for the first time, I really got into school.
Yeah.
And, you know, I went back and got a music degree and just started studying, cool. Just started digging in.
Yeah.
And that's the best decision I ever made, was just like, finally learning the musical language. Just, you know, I guess I got like a 2-year music degree at ACC and studied a lot of, you know, audio production and MIDI and synthesis programming and stuff like that. And
yeah,
it just kind of, you know, I got to where I was like, oh, I can learn whatever I want to learn. My brain works fine.
Yeah.
But it took just healing. It needed to be healed. There's no doubt.
Yeah.
I could have been a burnout.
There's also something about just kind of like making music and traveling that really, I mean, unless you don't drink and you're constantly sharpening your mind in some way.
Yeah.
You know,
where, yeah, you got to pick your, you got to read.
You get reboot. Dull.
Yeah.
You get dull is what it is. You don't, you're not as used to, you know, yeah, you got to reboot. You got to get yourself back in mental shape and stay strong and stay engaged.
Agreed. Very much.
I think that it's pretty amazing though, that you did go pretty heavily with the electronics. I mean, I remember running into you during that time. You had a thing with Laura Scarborough for a while where you guys were both doing that stuff. Is that right?
Yeah. We were, it's funny. I just did a show with Gumby the other night and we were doing, I mean, there were like a crossover of like 3 or 4 different groups of people. There was Thor and Friends that, you know, and I met like Rob Halverson through that. And
can I tell you something really fast? I'm sorry to interrupt you, but this is going to make you laugh. have a girlfriend that doesn't know any of those people and stuff, right? And so I was saying something, talking to someone on the phone, and I was like, oh, tell Gumby. I said, hi. She's like, you got a friend named Gumby? And I go, yeah, my friend Gumby was in a band with my friend Thor. And then she said, Thor, what does he look like? And I said, exactly what you think.
Yeah.
And I was like,
oh, the first time I ever heard of him, that's what Wham-O said, like in 1985. He's like, wow, I met this drummer named Thor, and he actually is Thor. You'll know him when you see him on the street.
I was like, you'll see him on a bike. He will probably not be wearing a shirt. He's still muscular as shit. I mean, yeah. He's still in amazing shape, and I know he's older than me.
Yeah, he's not too much behind me. He's closing in on 50.
Yeah.
Yeah. Other than a little bit of thinning on top of his hair, he's like,
right.
So
you met him, you met Rob Halvorsen.
Well, yeah, and a bunch of people. Thor was, Rob produced that record, yeah.
The new record.
My record. We've been collaborating in various capacities ever since then, and that was maybe not 20 years ago, late 90s.
Okay.
90, yeah, almost 6. 20 years ago. Yeah. So there was that, and then there was Mastica. Pat Mastalotto came along and had the band with Gumby and Monica, and so I started playing with them, and that's how I met Brad Hauser. He was playing with that too.
Right.
And then Laura and I had been friends since she was a kid, since she was a teenager in at UT. And I was working at Technophilia on the drag and selling, you know, like selling a lot of DJ and electronic music. And she was really into it. So I was turning her on to music. And then we just started playing. And it was all when I was in school and I was working two jobs, like I didn't have time to run a band or even rehearse. So I was doing all of, for like 2 or 3 years, that's all we did was like Rudamaya and art gallery gigs that were all improv abstract shit, you know, and it was the band that was called Sonica was me and Laura and
right.
Charles Reeser did it some and Daryl Phillips and Bernal and Rob Hooper and Brandon Harper but me and Laura were kind of the thrust of it, you know. We were just you know, figuring out how to use the gear, basically. You know, they were coming
sometimes
out with chaos pads and
out,
samplers
yeah.
and delays. You know, the Line 6 echo delay was coming out. We were just learning how to use all that. When they first put out the Nord leads, we were just, like, we were all teaching each other all of that stuff and just experimenting with it. And Genevieve, my ex-wife, was doing a lot of, she was finishing her modern dance degree, and she was a little bit older than a lot of girls she was working with, so we were able to get a lot of movement, which made it, you know, it gave it a little more something to it than just us. And it gave us an inspiration to play to, and it also made it more interesting for performance, for sure.
Yeah.
And so we just kind of did that for a while, you know, and it, yeah. It kind of led to, you know, when they moved Antones around the corner from Rudamaya, then a lot of the people I had played with from the Steamboat days that were, you know, playing in the blues and rock bands that were playing Antones would come around for their coffee and see us doing all this weird shit. So people knew I was doing that.
Right.
And I started getting asked, you know, and then at the same time, like, you know, Radiohead started really taking off and Wilco was mixing in that stuff.
Right.
And there were some of the bands that were more straight rock bands that were really getting textural with that. And so
Word for it, textural and more atmospheric.
Yeah.
Less than
and
like,
I remember, I mean, that's what y'all were doing too. You know, I totally remember, you know, after Rocket Baby, your music, that you were, it was the same thing. Like there was a lot of creating atmospheres with the effects and, you know, I was bored with playing funk guitar. I didn't want to do that anymore. And, but it kind of, that kind of led me into, you know, doing that kind of abstract stuff and getting adept at it, but also knowing how to play a rock song, you know? So I started kind of getting invited in, and that's how I wound up playing with Alejandro for a while was that, you know, he knew people that were more adept with the gear to make the textures, but they didn't know how to play in a rock band.
Right.
You know, and so.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and Hector and I had been friends for years, and Hector knew what I was up to. And he had come and played with us some in some of the jam sessions. And so between him and I believe, you know, I think that David was aware of what I was doing too. And I think the two of them told Al he should, you know, consider working with me on it and you know,
just to try something outside.
Yeah. And it, and you know, I showed up and I could sing, Here's one thing that happened, though, when like Al just kind of invited me to play some shows with him. And, you know, I had a lot of friends that had played with him. And Cornbread had been playing bass with him, but he wasn't going to play with him anymore. And he has given me some great advice over the years. And in that situation, him and Hector both told me, like, man, you may not be good with this, good, you know, with knowing the songs or playing keyboards. I had never played keyboards before, and I was playing keyboards in his band. But he's like, all the harmony players left the band. Nail all the harmonies and buy yourself time to learn the gear. And that's what happened, you know, like, because everybody from Louisiana can sing harmonies.
Yeah.
And so I learned all of Cornbread's and David Perales harmony parts and just, you know, I mean, you don't even have to be playing if you're nailing the harmonies, right? Then that's a pretty valuable thing.
Yeah.
So, and I did about a 5-year run with Alejandro, you know, touring and
shit. That's a long time.
Yeah.
It was a living too. I mean,
yeah.
And were you doing stuff outside during that time?
Well, I was, but it was hard. I mean, that's one of the reasons that I stopped playing with him was because it was just busy enough to keep other things from developing. Like, you know, we'd be off for a few weeks and I'd play with somebody a few times and then go on the road for 2 months, you know? So it wasn't enough to be a full-time job, but it also wasn't enough to, you know, but it didn't leave enough time to do something else.
Right.
And so, you know, it kind of plateaued out of what I was getting out of it.
Yeah.
You know, but I got a ton out of it. I mean,
being a sideman isn't like, I mean, I've done it a lot. It's like, it's got its shelf life. I mean, it just does.
That's the only time I've ever done it.
Yeah.
Really, you know, and it was, I mean, you know, I've been in bands where I was not frontman, but that was totally like, you know, I was hired to do some specific things. And I was given more leeway than he gave most people. You know, he just like, do what you do. But, you know, I mean, whatever. Like his taste in what he wants his music to sound like goes to different places. And, you know, things, like you say, things just run their course.
During that time, you were still married?
Yeah, yeah. Eller was about 5 or 6. The first 2 years I toured with Al, I was married. And I had turned down tours until Eller was 6. And when I started to go out, you know, I mean, we were close, you know, I was with him all the time. We were total, both of us worked and both of us stayed at home. And when I was leaving, you know, and he was sad about it, I was like, well, this is what I've always done. And I didn't do it because I couldn't have this conversation with you and tell you I'm coming back. You know, when you're like, when somebody's 2 years old, they don't know if you're coming back if you're gone for 2 months. But if he's 6 years old, you know, I talk to him on the phone and he knows I'm coming back. So that was really part of the logic of it. And, but it, you know, she wanted me to do it. She encouraged me to do it. I was kind of going back and forth. I was just about finished with my music degree and everything. And, but you know, it was just an opportunity. I got to be a musician again. I got to be a full-time musician again. So I quit school and went. And
that's who you are, man.
Yeah.
You're a musician.
Well, and yeah, so it just, but it took it, you know, it was a huge element of our marriage ending anyway, even though she was theoretically supportive of it.
Right, right.
It still was like, okay, well, you're gone all the time, you know.
Yeah, that's always a tough thing. But, you know, I mean, you guys still get along?
Oh, we're great. Too, I had dinner with last night with her and her daughter. She's one of my best friends, you know.
That's good.
Took a little while, but you know.
Takes a while, but you know, it's funny. I was just talking to those Rocket Baby guys, and I was talking to Brian Keeling, and he and I ended on not such a good note. But it's like, it's funny when you just look back like a little time, and everything is cool. You're like, I'm not that mad at you. I don't care.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah. There's no doubt. Grudges are like, the person holding it is the one who's poisoned.
Yeah. Yeah, and so anyway, so at the end of your tenure with Alejandro Escovedo, then you were like, I don't want to play rock and roll anymore.
Well, we did like, I did 2 years with him, and I was really hitting, I was plateauing out, and then he got really sick.
Oh, right.
And that was at a point that we were, like I had been going, we went, like during that year was when we really tried to fix our marriage and went to counseling. And, it was done.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, it's like a common story. A lot of us have had the same marriage counselors through Sims in Austin, for sure. I've seen a lot of my friends just, oh, hi. Yeah, it's pretty common. But so during that year off, you know, I was like, you know, it was the love of my life and our marriage ended. So I was a mess. I couldn't play. I'd got a job doing sound at the Continental Club just so I could be in music.
I remember seeing you there. Yeah.
And And it just really, you know, I quit playing because I knew the level I wanted to be at of showing up with my shit together, and I couldn't do it. I was showing up ill prepared, and like, you know, I was like, I should not be doing this if I can't do it right.
Yeah.
So I stopped. And then, you know, we split up, and then when I kind of got my feet back on the ground again, right when I finally got settled in a new place and I was like, okay, I'm starting to feel like the wind's coming back in my sails, then Al called me up, and that was right when his health got better again to tour. And he's like, I'm putting a band back together again. You want to do it? And I was like, yeah, who's in it? And he was like, well, right now, you and me. And I think Hector will do it too, you know? And so then he put a new band together, and so I did another 2 years with him. And then, you know, it just kind of reached... For one thing, I really am not a keyboard player, and that's what I was mostly playing with him. And he, you know, he had like either David Polkingham or John Dee playing guitar. And I mean, I'm a good guitar player, I think. I'm better now than I was then, but I mean, you know, those guys are like freaking top notch guitar players. Yeah. And so it was like, and I could manipulate sounds with the keys and play chords, but I was not expressing myself. And I did it for 7 years, you know, just like it's not my instrument to pour the expression out. That was a big chunk of why I quit. It was like, I stopped. I didn't really want to play rock and roll anymore was part of it too. Like, I just kind of was like, I mean, I don't want to say anything bad about anybody, but I really was like, I was in my early 40s and I was looking at people 10 years older than me playing songs that we had been playing since we were teenagers. And I had been studying, you know, I was getting capable of playing jazz and like a more sophisticated harmonic music. And I just was like,
I don't think there's anything. I mean, everyone's on their own journey. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know,
I just knew I just didn't want to keep trying to make it playing.
Yeah.
Punk songs.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that, you know, that's not
there's
all.
There's nothing wrong
all.
With that. Yeah. That's not where your head was at the time. Yeah. You've grown past it.
And that's yourself. Not at all to categorize. I mean, Alejandro has a pretty, as we all know, a pretty strong breadth of music and everything. But it's his songs. It's stuff he writes. There wasn't a lot of room for me to do the stuff that was boiling up in my head.
Sure.
And so I kind of, you know, I realized, like, I just got bored with using a laptop and with making music in that way. And I just shut it. And I kind of, you know, I broke up with somebody I've been dating for a few years. The same weekend I quit that band. And, like, I just was laying in bed doing nothing for a couple of weeks. And Eller got invited to a party that was a Hanukkah party that was some people that he was friends, the kids were friends, and I kind of knew one of the parents, and, you know, and he dragged me out of bed because he wanted to see his friends, and there was like a clown breathing fire, and somebody picked up an accordion and a washtub bass and started playing like Romani music and hobo music, and I just like went, how do you do that? You know, it was like, it was simple folk music and also like harmonically sophisticated music that just blew me away. And when I started playing it, I hadn't played guitar in like 3 years, and I picked up a guitar and like, I immediately could play the music. Like, I just knew it. And
you knew the language.
Yeah. And I had, you know, I had never, getting a music degree, I'd never applied it to guitar. I was still a real rudimental chordal guitar player, but when I was playing with Alejandro, when I would learn songs, I got to where I could read the hand position on the fretboard and transfer it to the keyboard. And so all of a sudden I was doing exactly the opposite thing. Like, I was watching the chord shapes on the accordion keyboard and turning it into guitar shapes. And it was a Dylan Blackthorne, you know, they had this band called That Damn Band. And, they asked me to join them. And he just taught me probably 120 songs in like a month and a half, just like we just played constantly, and I could keep up with it. And it just, you know, it got to where it got me over being uptight about creating musical masterpieces, because I was just learning these songs and I didn't know if somebody had written them last week or if they were 100 years old from the old world or something. It was just this barrage of songs, and a lot of them had weird titles that I couldn't remember, so I couldn't even really write charts or anything. It was just like, keep up with this stuff that was flying
feel
by
it.
Yeah, it just washed over me.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, use every trick possible. Yeah. You know, use ears and eyes of the key. You know, if you see, you know, a lot of the songs are in similar keys, and if you see a B flat on the keyboard, you know somebody's either playing a G minor or a B flat chord, you know. Yeah. So it's kind of like, it's only going to go so many places, but it's not the same place that the songs I was playing were going.
Right.
So it really kind of, and it just, you know, and then they really, right at that time, they started getting into playing klezmer music, and I was, you know, I was playing with people like Will Landon was playing tuba, and Sick was playing violin, and I mean, they were handing me stacks of sheet music every day. Like I just, we'd go to the convenience store and just make copies of shit out of books, and I just started learning all of it, you know, and it started making me be able to read lead sheets to guitar, which I had never done, but I had to do it because they were kicking my ass, you know. It was like they were all standing around a music stand and nailing these songs, and it was like, oh,
you had to be there too.
I needed to learn. Yeah, I want to keep up. So it totally kicked my ass for a couple of years, really, but. You know, I mean, I was bringing something to it.
But how exciting you weren't just kind of like sitting around, you know, making noise to the same songs. You were being challenged. You had to rise up to something.
It opened. I mean, I finally found my folk music. You know, I was always into doing weird stuff. And from all the psychedelic stuff, I had been influenced as a child and just thinking like avant-garde art and just being this original artist. It got me over that. It got me into this state of mind of like, the song is more important than the person that wrote it, whether you wrote it or not. You know, that's what I felt like. And because of that, it unhinged a writer's block to where I could write songs by not thinking that they had to be important. They were just in my head, so they were worthy of being sung. And if they stuck, they stuck. And that's still the way it is, really. It's like if something gets stuck in my head, I learn it, whether it's, you know,
something heard or
200
something
years old or Elton John or something that hasn't been written yet that just came, you know. But at the same, you know, I mean, you know, the way songwriting is like it's time for a new album. So it's like time to write a new batch of songs and I'll get in, you know, I'll do every trick in the book to force myself to finish stuff in a timely fashion, you know?
Yeah.
So.
That's awesome. Who's the guy that wrote the thing to me yesterday? That was so weird after we had talked. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you know him very well?
No. I mean, it was so weird that...
He did sound at Rudemeyer for years, and he did sound... He does sound at the one-to-one
now. I bet if I saw... Oh, I know exactly what you're talking about.
He's got glasses.
Yeah,
that was completely bizarre.
Yeah, that was really weird.
Because I saw him Sunday night. We played... He was doing sound at the John Bush thing.
Yeah.
And, I mean, he's been... You know, he was doing sound at Rudemeyer when Genevieve was dancing with us back 20 years ago, and so he has watched some... I mean, I don't know what he knew of me before then, but from then... We've been talking about music since, you know, the mid-90s, 20 years. So he's definitely been, he's run sound for me for 20 years in different places. So.
And then obviously different incarnations.
Yeah. And I mean, in the whole marching band thing too, you know, that's like a whole other angle of it. So.
Yeah, wait, what is, I have it written down. Oh, the Minor Mishap Marching Band.
Yeah.
I remember seeing pictures and then you were playing trombone?
Yeah. Yeah, I still play trombone. I mean, basically... When we, you know, when I started getting into klezmer music, I started playing trumpet again, and I got a trumpet, and then Daughtry Bean sent the word out through a lot of channels that she was trying to start a, you know, local marching band, and, you know, we knew of March 4th Band from Portland was coming through town, and that damn band had opened for them, and the Extra Action Marching Band from San Francisco had, you know, we were kind of aware that there were community marching bands that were like, you know, the freaks, the people... being really expressive in not the traditional militaristic or football game way, you know?
Right.
And so, you know, we just started doing it. And I'd always wanted to play trombone when I was a kid, but I just never played it. And when that was my idea when I joined that band. So I want to play trombone. And I went to the first practice and there was like, I was the only trumpet player and there were five trombone players. So I had to keep playing trumpet for a while and I recruited trumpets. And then after about 6 months, I switched over to trombone and just, you know, just dug in and got the sixth grade primer on learning it and just started all the klezmer tunes I had learned on guitar. I just started learning them on trombone and learning how to read the bass clef and learning that stuff. And then, you know, I mean, it's kind of easy. Like a lot of people that are in those bands are all over the country. You know, the honk scene is huge. There's bands like that in every city now. And there's like four or five of them in Austin now. It's totally.
Really?
There's a Yes Ma'am band and the Dead Music Capital band and. Urban Achievers and, you know, varying degrees of amateurism and professionalism. And, but like the basis of what happened in a lot of the cities was, you know, people would come together who were either ex-band people that hadn't picked up in their adult life because they didn't have some avenue like that that was similar to the way people jam in rock bands where, oh, we'll just get together and have a blast, you know?
Yeah.
And then there were other people who had never played, but because you're hidden in a 20-piece band, you can just kind of peck out the parts and gradually get your legs under you, which is what I did on the trombone, you know? And so they're still doing that, you know, and it's going, you know, Minor Mishap is like a full-on community social event.
What kind of stuff do you do? Do you get marching band music from like...
Not really. Daughtry writes a lot of music. I mean, in different communities...
It's original music.
Yeah, but I mean, there's also like, you know, at the honk events, there are standards that go from band to band. You know, there's like, pull up, what's the name of that? Pull up the bumper that... Ba-da-da-da-da. Ba-da-da-da-da-da, the one that's like ba-dum, bum bum ba-dum, bum bum ba-da-da, ba-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, you know, whatever. There's just standards, and some of them are like, you know, Balkan music that everybody knows, Bela Chow, and I mean, at the honk fests are like insane. It's a huge, like, I can go to any of the cities where the marching bands and just, it's like the way punk rock was in the 80s, like people... put each other up, and you can play with any of the bands. Like the band I play with now at the honk festivals is from Chicago, and they welcome a lot of the orphans, and you know,
it's its own community.
Oh, it's huge, and they have it. The next one is I'm not sure if it's next weekend or the one after. I think it's the second weekend of October in Boston, which is where the first honk festival started. I think this might be the ninth one. And they'll tie one together. It'll be in Boston from like Friday to Sunday. And then Monday it'll be in Providence. Everybody will take a train. Everybody that doesn't go back to work will take a train to Providence. And
that's awesome.
And then the next weekend they'll all go to Brooklyn and do, I think they call it the Bronx Fest, which I haven't ever stayed that long. And then the one in Austin, like I helped start, and Jason Fialkoff is a real heavy force he's a director of it. And it's just a nonprofit community thing, you know? And it's like, it's really... it's had a huge influence on, I've seen it on more people than me that are people like me that are professional, up and down music career, like of really replenishing the joy of playing music again. And for some people, it's people who have day jobs and that's their musical outlet. It's like their bowling league or whatever, you know, it's like the thing they have a bunch of friends and they get to get on stage at Antone's and make a little money and play in parades. And I mean, it's more DIY to me than punk ever was because you don't have to sell booze to do it and you don't need a club and you don't need an amplifier and you don't need electricity or anything.
You don't need anything.
You just need a bunch of people to
get
make something exponentially bigger than themselves, which, you know, it's older than any of the other stuff we've been doing.
Yeah.
And I still go down there. I participate with a band called Gregory Strutt that's a dance troupe down in New Orleans, and you know, they just had their auditions for new dancers this week, and I go play trombone. I'll go down there and have a couple of rehearsals, and they kind of piece band together, and I march in some parades every Mardi Gras with them.
That's fun.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, that's when I was a little kid in New Orleans, and you know, I vividly remember seeing the trombone players in the marching bands and wanting to do that. And I finally got to do it, you know, I was like 46 years old or something. I finally got to play trombone in some Mardi Gras parade, you know? So
that's a great time.
Yeah,
man. It's awesome that you mentioned that about feeling, you know, excitement about playing music, because that's the toughest thing when you're a professional and you go on as long as we have, it's still like trying to find that weird feeling.
Yeah,
it's almost like cocaine or something, like trying to find that weird feeling you had when everyone was together in a garage and was just playing. There was no reason to do it. It was just some sort of like freedom that you never had before. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh yeah, for sure.
And you're chasing that high.
Well, like, I mean, for me, the real secret that I accidentally discovered, but now it's conscious, is like learning a new instrument is like becoming a 5-year-old with finger paints again, where it's just like, well, does it actually have to be on the paper or can it be on the rug and the furniture too? You know, it's just kind of like, and you don't care that you suck. And it's like, you know, I mean, it's a hard thing for an adult who's got an ego and wants to look cool or whatever to be that way. But once you take that leap, then you're fucking free. You know, it's just like, Awesome. I'm a knucklehead. Kind of I'm an idiot. It's yeah. okay. You know, I don't have to be cool. I mean, especially, yeah. I mean, I'm going to be 53 years old tomorrow. I was like, I'm not cool anymore. You know, it's just kind of like, you just be a dork and wear weird glasses or whatever, you know?
Yeah. I think you're cool.
So, well, thanks. But I mean, you know what I mean? It's kind of like relative to, I mean, we're cool to each other. I don't know. I mean, when I was having a hard time, I hit the crisis of confidence finishing my record, you know, and I told my son, I told Eller that, you know, he's 19 last summer, and he just was like, I think what you're doing is important. And it was like, you know, just the fact that I was inspiring him is enough reason to do it, enough reason to finish it. You know, it'd be the worst thing in the world for me to just give up and be defeated while my son is trying to decide what he's going to do with his life because he's becoming an adult, you know?
Yeah.
And it, you know, that carries over in everything. It's like everything you do that's forward motion, somebody is going to be inspired by it. And that's like what, you know, and if you do that enough, then you get the rewards. You don't have to like try to count every dollar, you know, you get to keep going.
Yeah.
That's what it feels like.
I got to say, I was really impressed. I saw him on a talk show and I was with my girlfriend. I was like, man, that's my friend's son. Like, I mean, I saw a kid, like maybe he was 2 or 3 or 4 or something. The last time he looks the same to me. It's weird. His face is, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like it's still there. But I was like, yes, amazing. You know, to see whatever people do when they're on TV. He seemed like a perfectly well-rounded, nice human being. He didn't seem like some idiot that you'd see on The Bachelor or something. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
He's not a douchebag. He's obviously getting some pretty huge fucking accolades. And
he doesn't take it seriously.
That he might not have noticed he was even working on for so long. You know what I mean? But that must be a gratifying experience as a parent.
That's by far the thing I'm the most proud of him for. I mean, he's like, he's graceful and he's humble.
Yeah.
And he, I mean, you know, he made my mother proud. He made his grandma proud when he was on The Tonight Show. You know, it's like there's nothing else more that can really be said than that. He could have been a dick.
Yeah, I don't think he's a dick, though.
He's not at all. Yeah. It's kind of amazing. And he had no experience at talking to more than like 15 or 20 people. And suddenly the movie came out, and within 5 minutes, he was talking to 1,200 people in an auditorium, and he was just like, I don't know where it came from. I mean, he's an old soul.
Came from good parenting, man.
Well, to a certain degree, maybe. I mean, I'm grateful to hear that. And I, you know, we tried. We love him, and you can. But at the same time, it's like, I mean, you know, there's a lot of really brilliant, creative people that, I mean, we're surrounded by hundreds of them.
Sure.
That, like, you know, having all the ducks fall in a row to have a hit single or whatever is like, to a certain degree, it's winning the lottery. And it's the same thing with a movie being a hit or whatever.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of it being the lottery, you know, to a certain degree. But what he's got something that is, he's got a charisma that an agent saw when he was 5 years old, you know, and it's like, it's an extension of that is what's happening now. I think him, you know, he was on tour with Alejandro when he was 8 years old, you know, so he kind of, and he's been making a movie with people that are big movie stars since he was 6. So he's really not—he's not starstruck. He's not impressed by it. He takes much more credence of somebody being a genuine person than of the heap of bullshit that people blow up each other's ass in the entertainment business. You know, he really—that's what he looks for—is just like people that treat people right.
Yeah, it must be cool to come up in it, because then you kind of like come out, like when it's time for you to enter the business yourself, when you come up around it, you kind of know that's what, as long as you got grounded parents that are always looking for like real people and real experience and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like Alejandro and John D and Hector and Susan Veltz and Ethan and Patricia were like his aunts and uncles.
Yeah.
And, you know, those are professional artists, seriously professional artists that have been doing it for decades. And, you know, there's a lot of people that aren't those people that he also came across that are examples of how not to treat people, you know, and it's all, you know, everybody makes their own judgment, I guess, but
that's right.
What's the quality you absorb?
Yeah. But it's good. I'm glad that you're happy.
Oh yeah,
and you feel good. I'm very. I think that A Barrel of Monkeys, what I heard of it today, is amazing. I'm really looking forward to seeing you do this live. I'd love to see you play solo. How long you run? before you go?
I'm leaving Friday. Okay. You want to talk about that? How that came about for a second?
Yeah,
this actual story.
You know? Oh yeah, dude. Let's talk about that. Let's talk about everything.
Well, yeah. I mean, what happened after? I had I was really studying a lot of that music with That Damn Band and The Inheritance and Minor Mishap, and I kind of got burned out on doing bands. Like, I got, you know, how it happens. You work so hard on a collaboration and it ends and you feel discouraged because, oh, all the work is back to square one.
Yeah.
And I've been doing more and more music for, like, kind of guerrilla theater stuff, Commedia dell'arte, and doing the music for the Austin Bike Zoo. The Commedia troupe is called La Fenice, and it's Eller's mom is in it, and it's people I've known for about 20 years. And once I started doing kind of street music and, you know, more acoustic stuff that had old influences, like, I started writing the music for their plays. And so in doing the music for them, I wound up with these opportunities, particularly out in West Texas, to, like, do a set of music by myself, and people liked it. Like, I immediately started getting booked back to go by myself or to bring my own band or whatever. And it just was like a light bulb, you know, just like, oh, yeah, I'm ready to do this. You know, it's like I was 50 years old, and it was just kind of like, I always figured someday that would happen, but it took a long time.
Yeah.
I'm glad I'm still alive, you know?
Yeah.
But so basically, like, I just really started digging in and playing at places that would have me, and like some of the farmer's market and restaurant gigs that I had been doing with The Inheritance, I just turned them into my own gigs. Started inviting different people, whoever was around and wanted to play, and started really learning songs a lot. You know, things that kind of all, whatever I heard that I just kept learning songs. I was in the same way, but following direction that was just influenced by my taste, really. And it just kind of turned into where I was doing, you know, I started doing it 5 days a week and was like, oh man, I'm making more money doing this than I am at my job. And I'm not really playing at bars that much, you know, but just if there's one person playing a farmer's market and making $200 is like, you know, it's a lot more than making most bands that I play, and they're really popular, you know?
Yeah.
And so it just kind of started happening and pushing in that direction and going out of town a little bit. And, you know, there are places, you know, it's Austin's just the supply and demand of music, and demand, there's a lot of musicians here now, so there are people that'll do gigs for free, but there's a lot of smaller communities around that just love it when people like us come through and sing songs and mean it, and they, yeah, can listen to somebody really play music, because it's, yeah, like it's not there. There's not so many people that are as good,
yeah,
at a higher level of what we've all pushed each other to be, right, around here. So it just kind of started happening, and I just had this whole pool of musicians, you know, some of the people I'd played with before, like Michelle Alani and Amanda Kitchens, and I just started meeting more people, and, you know, in jam situations, I met John Bush, and I had known Brad, and he just approached me about wanting to play with me, and then Laura came back and started wanting to learn the music I was doing, and it just kind of, you know, it hit a point where I realized I was ready to quit my job, and I needed to make a record of the, yeah, songs I was writing. So, you know, I started that like last summer with Rob Halverson, and we recorded a lot of it at his studio, and I did a lot of overdubs either at my house or just, you know, carrying around my Mac and some good mics. And I recorded Sick down in New Orleans, and Elizabeth Lee sent some vocal tracks from Italy.
Oh,
and
that's cool.
And it kind of was like, I got really excited about this pool of people I had been playing with. And I realized when I was helping advise somebody on a record they're working on out in West Texas a couple weeks ago, I realized that, like, I wasn't so much thinking, oh, this needs violin. I would think, oh, this needs Michelle on it. You know, it almost,
right,
like,
right,
it didn't matter what instrument she played.
Yeah, yeah,
and
then
same thing with Will Landon playing,
sure,
tuba, or,
yeah,
Donnie Wynn plays some drums, and John Bush plays some drums, and it's kind of like, this song needs that. And so I got really carried away with it. It was like the first record I'd ever done. So I kind of was like, you know, it has, I think, 15 or 16 different people on it. And
yeah, it has a lot of people.
And it's all these people I was writing these songs with. And it was like, oh man, I really like, you know, I like the way what Laura's harmony or vibes is on that song. Or,
yeah,
or this needs sousaphone, you know, it needs Will on it, or whatever it was. And then some of it was just pieced together. But, you know, it was just a blast. And I needed a collaborator because I had never done a record without a band, and I felt like I was unable to rein the canvas in to something that made sense. But now I feel, now I learned that from Rob. He was a great, great producer to work with, and he really kind of helped me narrow it down into, you know, specific ideas. And so now I'm going to do one just pretty much by myself, you know. I'm going to hole up and write some songs in Florida and set up a studio at my mom's house and do something kind of raw that's mostly guitar and voice and percussion.
Wow.
So that's what's next. Kind of about my journey.
Yeah.
Went up to Alaska and, you know, through California and went to Burning Man and spent a lot of time out in West Texas and just kind of got a lot of stories from that.
Yeah.
Alaska's a whole nother world, you know.
Definitely. Definitely. So, was it a positive? Is Alaska a positive place to be?
Unbelievable. Like exponentially better than I expected it to be.
That's cool.
You know, and I'm bringing a trio back there, and I have festival dates booked already, and teaching at a camp. And I met a really good bass player up there who lives down here too, named Janie Cowan. And I stayed with her and taught her a lot of music, and we got a lot of gigs there. And now she's back down in Austin, but she's going up there in the summer. So we're kind of collaborating and hoping that Amanda's going to go up there and play with us too. And we're going to do trios and, you know, pick up a drummer up there and play up there.
That'll be great.
So,
and so people can find all your stuff if they go to Bandcamp, or not Bandcamp, Reverb Nation.
And yeah, I mean,
Bruce
Salmon. I'm, you know, I finished the record and then went on the road for 4 months. So I don't have, sure. I mean, I have some songs that are on Reverb Nation to listen to.
Right.
I never got any of it. Like, I was traveling without a computer. So, okay. I just put what I put in before I left. And so I'm planning on, you know, I'm about to woodshed for a few months, and part of it is like getting my online presence a little bit tighter and more professional and have stuff more available, you know, get it all. There's a lot of videos flying around that different people took, you know, just getting them all sourced in one place and getting the music online for download and everything.
Yeah.
It's just not there right now. Like, I just haven't done it.
It's interesting because it seems like nowadays, as wide as everything is, and it's kind of like there's nothing really seems specific to now anymore. It's just kind of like everything is happening at once. There's guys wearing like skinny jeans but have like a 1920s mustache and then like a Hitler haircut or something. It's like totally fucked up. So it is interesting though, because it seems that if you can find something and be specific to it, you can find an audience, and you don't need to sell a million records to make a living and to keep on traveling and growing an audience. It seems like now all of us are able to sort of like, we can have an audience, and it might not be as big as we had once dreamed an audience would be, but you're able to sort of like maintain and live.
Well, I think what you're describing of what we thought it could be is like really specific to a couple of generations. I mean,
it's really ridiculous.
The first year that LPs outsold 45s was 1968. And then until like whatever, the mid 90s, when everybody started downloading and burning everything.
Yeah.
It's like, so people were rewarded like the Rolling Stones and whoever for being millionaires for a while. And then it all went away. And it's like,
but that's
do
not
we really deserve that?
About.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I do basketball players deserve $40 million and teachers get paid $30,000? Yeah. Whatever. Who knows? But I mean,
well,
one
I
thing
so.
That there's been a philosophical thing that, you know, I've come to, and specifically some people have said, it's things I've talked about. And I've become good friends with Mark Rubin in the last couple of years. And, you know, just this idea that, He's voiced some things that put into words what I was feeling. And it's just kind of like, you know, being a craftsman that is serving a purpose in your community, you know, being a craftsman at what you do. Like, there is a need in this, and doing a lot of that folk music. It's just like, somebody needs to play those songs for people to dance to, you know? And if it's already being played, then you don't need to do it. And if there's 20 people waiting in line and you want to play it, then maybe you should go to another community or a different dance or something, you know.
Right.
But just that sense of like, if you just keep working on your craft and stay versatile and adaptable to where, you know, it's like I can play songs at a farmer's market for little children in the morning, and I can play filthy, dirty music in a bar at 3 a.m. in Alaska, you know. And it's like, and there's a lot of room in between there of like playing for old people, older people, and having some old jazz standards that make them feel good, and playing some dirty stuff that sounds fresh for people that are out, you know, for people in their 20s that are out drinking on a Friday night, you know, and it's, you know, learning, just being adaptable and not being too locked in. You know, I mean, aspiring to be true to yourself. And I mean, for me, I sing songs that I sing them. They're in my heart and I want to sing them, but just kind of going ahead and learning them and not questioning them if they don't seem to fit. Yeah. I learned Goodbye Yellow Brick Road this summer. It really doesn't fit with the rest of my set. And sometimes it's like farting in a room to play it, but sometimes it's the perfect song to play, you know?
Yeah.
And I couldn't get it out of my head, so I learned it, you know?
Yeah, that's fucking, you're an artist, man. You're a real artist. And I'm glad.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
Likewise.
Yeah, man. Yeah, this has been a great, enlightening conversation. Is there anything that I'm missing you want to say?
Not really. This isn't going to go on before tomorrow, right?
Yeah, no. Nobody's gonna hear this. It won't be on, actually, for a couple weeks.
Yeah. I don't know what else.
Look for him. If you're out there, look him up. Your dates are on the Reverb Nation page.
Yes, I keep up with that. And I'll, you know, by the end of the year, I'll have a little more online presence and, you know, CDs out there and songs out there for download and everything.
All right. I look forward to hearing what you do the next thing. But you're going to just kind of record it on your own? Do like an actual solo?
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
One thing I realized, being in Texas and being a guitar player, like, there's not a lot of guitar solos on the record I just made. I really like violin a lot as lead instrument. And when I was out playing by myself in California and Oregon and Alaska and, you know, Arizona and everything, you play a good guitar lead, people's head turn in a way that doesn't happen in Austin. And so it really kind of encouraged me more. And when I was traveling, I wound up playing guitar in other people's band and like really being valued as a guitar player. And so that's kind of my goal is, you know, to use that. Like I've been playing for, you know, 25 years, I've been playing guitar so I can play.
Yeah.
And to just kind of like really dig in with a lot of different textures and using slide and using electric and acoustic and resonator and just kind of make a record that uses the guitar and voice, you know?
Yeah.
So, and have that kind of dictate. You know, I also don't, if I'm going to keep doing it, I don't want to be, I want to push things to when I play by myself that it's not just a guy with a guitar. You know, I want to mix in percussion and textural electronics and bring back some of the stuff that I, you know, have chops in that I haven't been using.
Yeah.
And experiment with them and see what works, you know, and kind of write songs in that way and see what, whatever that is going to be is what's going to happen next, I guess.
It's going to be fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I have, you know, I've been doing it for 2 years and it's really like, it's a good time to kind of sit back and I have the opportunity to do that because I'm going to go stay with my mother and help her out for a while, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm just going to kind of hole up and...
Are you going to be at the beach? Because those beaches are so nice.
Oh, man. I'm going to get the beach every day.
Yeah, it's gorgeous.
Really happy to be there in October because the weather's still nice, but the tourists are gone and the snowbirds aren't there yet. Yeah.
Perfect. Well, man, have a great time. It's been great catching up.
Likewise, Johnny. Thanks very much.
Bruce Salmon, what a great guy, man. Great conversation. Really, you know, man, you forget. I think that we're all trying to get somewhere so hard, you know, doing this thing that we forget that, you know, just playing music. He's just out there playing. He's grateful to be out there making his music, doing stuff with different people, playing in community marching bands. That is a crazy, I got to get some of those guys in here. Find out what's happening with community marching bands. How are you doing out there, people? I hope that you enjoyed this podcast. I hope that you get out there and pick up Bruce Salmon's album, A Barrel of Monkeys. Find him on Facebook. I'm sure there's places to find it. You can find it at Waterloo and End of an Ear here in Austin. If you are out somewhere, you might have to find it on the internet. Probably like a CD Baby situation, maybe. I don't know. Find it for download. Bruce Salmon, great guy. So while you're out there looking up A Barrel of Monkeys on the internet, don't forget to like us on Facebook. We have a Facebook page. You can also subscribe to this podcast on iTunes. You can also make it one of your favorites on Stitcher if you listen to podcasts that way. Or find out. Just go to the page and listen to them. You know, that's fine too. But subscribing, you get to find out. If you like our Facebook page, you'll find out who's coming up. I post a picture of myself and tell you who's coming up the next day. put a picture of myself and the guest, not just myself. Hey, here's me just sitting around. Are you enjoying this photo of me? Enjoy it. Enjoy it. I'm cute. Okay, so you can also, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Johnny Gowdy. And also Instagram, I'm at Johnny Gowdy. Let's listen to another song from Bruce Salmon from his album, A Barrel of Monkeys. And remember, man, music, you do it because you love it, like Bruce Salmon. All right? We're all out there. We're all in the struggle of trying to make our thing happen. I'm trying to make this podcast happen. But really what I'm doing is hanging out and talking to people and getting into it. When you're going out there and you're trying to make your band happen, yeah, man, you got to try and make it happen. But remember, you're just up there playing music. Enjoy it while you're doing it, like Bruce Salmon. All right? Let's hear some more music from his album, Barrel of Monkeys. Bruce Salmon, let's get down.
Chance to say